More Money, More Problems was being shot at a golf course in Staten Island. And the Locks were there, and they had a friend of theirs with them who was just like, he was going around asking everybody, did they rap? Did they want to battle? This, and it was DMX. And he was just like systematically ripping anybody that thought they could rap, or the Pete from the PAs to everybody, to the grid. Anybody that thought they could rap or had verses, he was tearing them apart. And
Wow.
that was the first time I met DMX. And you know, he was definitely an interesting dude, man, a powerful human being. And yeah, that was just, I remember that specifically because he would just not stop. He was rapping when didn't want to battle. He said he would just go and people would form around him, and he was, it was dope. But that was on that set.
First I say, what we gonna do? Then you say, I don't know, what do you want to do? What we gonna do, what you want to do?
I have an idea.
You're gonna dig this.
The Fly Fidelity Podcast
is the solution.
It's the best.
Check it out.
You wanna get super fly.
Details just ahead.
Do you love
credible content,
but hate
how long you have to wait?
And who wants
super thick and frothy dumpster juice with rat corpses in it?
There's a better way.
Fly Fidelity.
Fly Fidelity.
Fly Fidelity.
Fly Fidelity.
Fly.
Fly. Fly Fidelity.
Fidelity.
Fly Fidelity Podcast.
Fly Fidelity, baby. Fidelity, baby. Fidelity.
With your host, Luke Bailey.
Welcome to the program. This week, director Benny Boone joins us for a sit-down to discuss his iconic career, pushing rap iconography to new levels in the 2000s. We'll also be talking about his collaborations with Nas, Mobb Deep, 50 Cent, LL Cool J, and so much more on this episode.
How did growing up in Philadelphia influence and inform your range of perspectives as a filmmaker?
Well, it's interesting. You know, Philly is a blue collar city, very blue collar. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, 70s as a little kid, and then the 80s as a teenager, and then the 90s in my college years. So, you know, it was very informative. It's a neighborhood city. I had tons of family all over different parts of the city. So I would, you know, at any time could go and visit an aunt or uncle and stay over in a different part of the city. And, you know, the way that they played street football or street basketball was kind of like the same. Maybe the rules were a little different than what we played in West Philly. They played in North Philly and that kind of thing. It was a fun city to grow up in. In the 70s and 80s, everybody kind of looked out for each other. A lot of the population migrated up from the South, from the rural South. So we were the generation that were born in the city, where others, like, you know, my father was from Virginia, my mother was born in Philadelphia, but a lot of my friends, their parents were from the South. And so, you know, it was that homey feel. So if you were doing something out of pocket and your friend's mother was there, she automatically had the right to chastise you or correct you, and then would tell your mother later, this is what happened. You know, that was those days. And so it sort of gave me the sense of community, the sense of belonging, sense of understanding. I didn't have any brothers. So Philly is a very fighting city at that time. Boxing was really big, and just fighting in general kind of felt like you had to fight for everything. And so I would find myself in a fight with a kid and then had to fight his older brother, you know, just because. So it definitely toughened you up really quick and, you know, gave me sort of this understanding of a world outside of that, like what exists outside of this that I'm kind of stuck in and trying to navigate, you know.
When you think about the 70s through to the 80s and those consequential years of consuming TV and films as a child, what was it about both of those decades and their cultural weight and that consciousness to work for you personally?
So it's very, you know, I always had this fascination with the visual media of television, movies, and that sort of thing. And what I mean by that is, I have a very vivid memory of seeing Jaws as a child. My grandmother took me to see it. And it was fascinating to watch. It was scary. I had a few nightmares about it, but it definitely awakened me into an understanding of what movies could actually do to you on a emotional level. And so that was like the first thing that woke me up before, you know, you're watching Sesame Street or television and that sort of thing. But it was Jaws that really made me go, wait a minute, this is, you go to a movie theater, you could watch this, and this experience stays with you. The next film that sort of did that for me was Star Wars, which was a few, like 2 years later. And because it spoke directly to the things that I kind of was interested in, it left a lasting impact. So you complement that with what was going on in television at the time. I think I was too young to understand the lack of representation on television for African Americans. So when Good Times was on, or The Jeffersons was on, or Sanford and Son was on, and these are three sitcoms, we just consumed it the way it was presented to us because we were quote unquote programmed, right? And so that programming made you believe and understand and think that this is the way it is and this is how it should be. So you have the movies, you have the television where you're watching yourself. And, you know, to be quite frank, we were okay with it because, you know, we saw it. We didn't know that and understand that there were so many other hours of television that did not have us in it. Right. So that's the 70s. The late 70s and the 80s start to come around and there is more representation on television. My visual world view opens up with more films and I start to try to make sense of why TV, like the visual look of television, is different than film. And so then understanding those formats of video versus the format of a film was kind of what sparked everything for me. And I would say I was probably like 13 or 14 years old at that time. And that would have been the mid 80s, yeah.
Who would have been some of those influences that turned you to a creative path and purpose and helped you be passionate outside of this program you're talking about? Who pushed you to think about your own ideas and the possibilities of articulating these visions as a director when you were coming up?
Yeah, it's, I don't know. It's, that's a great question. Wow, no one's ever asked me that. I think what happened for me was that I got so immersed in hip hop and I was so like, man, it was bigger than anything that you could experience at that time, right? So 78, 79, Rapper's Delight comes on the radio. You start, the block parties are happening. Block parties in Philly were a very, very big thing in the summertime. You know, they would block the street off and the DJ would come out and, you know, the whole block would come out and food and all this stuff. People from other blocks would come. They would organize it so that, you know, people tried not to have their block parties on the same, you know, the same day, you know, that kind of thing. So hip hop became the soundtrack for us. You know, the Generation Xers towards the late 70s, early 80s, because we could not get into clubs and that sort of thing. So that's sort of where it started. And then the AM radio stations where you would have to record for like 4 hours on a Saturday. You just press record on your cassette tape and just let it rock. You know, so that you could have it and listen back until next week, because they did not play hip hop on the radio at all during the week, only on Saturday, only on the AM radio station. That made me want to be part of that community and part of that. And that's what, you know, at first I was a rapper. That's where the name Benny Boom comes from. It's my rap name. And yeah. And so that really started my, I would say that started my creative journey. And when I got to college is when I found this program at Temple University. It was a radio, TV, and film program. And I said, this could be interesting. Like me exploring the idea of film and television as a major in college. I mean, that was amazing for me. So that's kind of where it came together. I think my pursuit of some sort of creative outlet is what led me to actually enroll in that curriculum at school. You know, so it's hard to say. It's really hard to say if there was like one particular person, because to be honest, this no one was doing this. I mean, you got to keep in mind, like, Do the Right Thing came out in 1989 or 88, or something, like 89. We didn't have Black filmmakers that spoke to us from that generation that had movies in the theaters, and he was the only one. You know, he had School Days before that, which was, you know, about college and pledging and that sort of thing. And then, you know, Fight the Power, you know, Do the Right Thing and Fight the Power comes out. And that is a direct correlation to what hip hop was at that time. And so there wasn't as if there was, you know, multi-layered amount of directors and producers that you could tap in. It just didn't exist. You know, there was one voice. Yeah, it was Spike Lee, you know, so.
Let's talk about Spike. You mentioned going to college. What was that progression like in moving from Philly and living in Brooklyn, where you end up landing this position of location intern for Spike, mm-hmm. and working with 40 Acres? How was that experience?
It's interesting. So Temple, so I went to Temple University, which is in Philly. So I stayed at home for my 4 years of school. At home, meaning in my city, I lived on campus. But I had the full, as full of a college experience as you could. I mean, Temple is a PWI, what they call a PWI, is a predominantly white institution. But we treated it like a HBCU, the collective that was there. So, you know, I pledged Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated in the spring of 1991. I was actually the only pledge that year, in Alpha at my school. So I was a solo, which was its own situation. And so that experience of school, because, you know, you're being bombarded with the ideas of filmmaking and editing and script writing and acting and all these things in a concentrated form, and you're getting graded on it and you're living and breathing it, was just incredible for me. So when I graduated, there was a guy who, his name is Adam. He worked for 40 Acres, but he actually went to Temple, and he was a few years ahead of me, but we had one class together, and we were cool. And I happened to just run into him one day on the subway in Philly. He had come back to Philly. He was from New York, but he'd gone to Temple. He'd come back to Philly, and he, saw me, and he said, "Hey man, how you doing?" I said, "Man, I'm great. I'm graduating this year." And I said, "You know, I want to move to New York. I really want to try to get in this business." And he said, "Give me a call. I'm working for 40 Acres and a Mule. I might be able to do something for you." I said, "All right, cool." Right. So, you know, you get those things a lot of times. I'm not sure your career path and how you got where you are, but a lot of times people will say, "Hey, give me a call," and you know, and then nothing happens, right? Or you call them, can't get in touch, or this. And so I called him, I think a week before, maybe not a week, maybe a couple of months, like a month or so before graduation. I said, "Hey, I'm really serious. I'm setting myself up to move up there." He said, "Okay, we got a movie starting. You know, it probably won't go into production until the end of June, early July. So if you come up here around that time, it'll be perfect." I said, "All right, great." Had everything lined up, had a place to stay. One of my frat brothers had an apartment in Brooklyn, around the corner from Spike Lee's office, which was such a coincidence. And everything was great, except it was an internship, so there was no pay. So it was an internship in the locations department. One thing about film school is we talked editing, we talked acting, we talked shot listing, we talked camera angles, we talked shooting. We never talked locations, like as a concept. Right. And I didn't know what that was, actually. I was like, so you mean we just get up and we find the locations and we just make sure they're ready for when they want to come and shoot? He said, yeah. I said, all right, it's a way in. And that's where it started for me. I met a lot of people. The movie was called Clockers. I met a lot of folks from that movie that I'm still very close to this day. That was 30 years ago. And it was the start of my, you know, my career in New York in filmmaking.
How quickly did you learn about locations in that period?
Well, it was interesting because I was on the film for about a month. I didn't have a lot of money with me. I think I moved to New York with like $1,500. And then by the time I had to give some money to rent and food and all this, you know, I was coming up short. And so I needed to find a paying job. So I didn't want to just do anything. I wanted to stay in this film world. And someone on the shoot said, hey, they're hiring PAs on a movie called Die Hard 3. So it's the, you know, it's Die Hard, the Bruce Willis, but it's the third, it's the trilogy. And I said, really? I said, yeah, the kid told me, he said, I can't do it because I'm stuck here on Clockers, but maybe if you show up in my place, they won't know. I said, aha, you know, they're just expecting, you know, they called, but you know, it wasn't as like organized as it is nowadays. Yeah. And so I did just that. I showed up in the kid's place to set at 5 a.m. in a place called Washington Heights, which I'd never been to in my life before. And it's, you know, it's about an hour away from Brooklyn on the train, on the subway. And that's where I got my first paying gig in film.
Detective John McClane is back home in the Big Apple.
This is a bad idea.
With a reluctant partner.
She don't like me because I'm white.
I don't like you because you're going to get me killed.
A splitting headache.
Got any aspirins?
And a killer deadline.
Plenty of time to test those wits of yours.
Bruce Willis, Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Oh, I'm having a wonderful day.
Rated R.
Basically, working on movies in New York was very organized. I mean, extremely organized in terms of the time you show up, you know, where you're supposed to be on a lockup, the hours in the day, all those kind of things. And it gave you structure. Music videos had no structure, really. It was sort of a free for all. So when I got a chance to actually be a production assistant for Hype Williams, I had brought with me all this, like maybe 2 or 3 years of consistent film work as a production assistant. So I was working for Woody Allen, Arnold Schwarzenegger on Eraser. I worked on a film called Sabrina with Harrison Ford. Like all these films, I was like the key PA for most of these films, all through the early and mid, you know, through the mid 90s. When I started to work for Hype, I brought all that sort of structure to what was happening in music videos. And the main AD, a guy named Mike Ellis, kind of recognized that along with Hype and made me an assistant director under him. And then I went on to become like a first assistant director later on.
So how do you initially meet Hype? And what was your relationship with his work up until that point?
So like everybody else, you know, it was such a magical time in New York at that time, 95, 96, 97. You're talking the emergence of Bad Boy Records. You're talking Nas. You're talking Wu-Tang Clan, Loud Records. You're talking Mobb Deep. I mean, this was, incredible. And there was every night there was a different one or two different I would say hip hop parties at major clubs all over New York City, whether it be the Tunnel or the Limelight or Rebar or Club New York or, you know, any of these places, Club Exit. These places hosted parties with DJs like Mark Ronson and Stretch Armstrong. This was the place to be at that time. And so along with the music, the visuals, Hype was just, man, he was creating just amazing, amazing spectacles of images that were just, you just couldn't believe it. No one was doing what he was doing. And he was taking the hip hop art form that was underground and basically slapping everybody in the face with it and said, hey, this, you guys need to pay attention to this because this is what the future is and the future is now. And so I actually got introduced to him through a commercial. I was a PA on a commercial that someone else was directing for 1-800-COLLECT. And Chris Rock used to do, he was the spokesperson for 1-800-COLLECT, which at the time was like, I think you would buy a card or sign up for this thing for your phone and you could make free long distance phone calls up to a certain amount of money. And they were producing the commercial out of Big Dog Films, which was Hype's company. And that's where I met Hype, in that office. And one day they said, hey, we need somebody to PA on a shoot with Hype. Anybody available over the weekend? And we were only shooting during the week. So I said, yeah, I'm available. And that was like Gotham City Remix video with R. Kelly. And that was the first job. And from there, we just clicked. You know, he sort of paid attention to me. I was observant. I was ready. You know, I was quick on my feet, making things happen. I was humble. I didn't have an ego, no attitude, any of that stuff. So it really helped me. It helped me move up.
Take me into a typical shoot with Hype back then. What did you learn from seeing him operate in those moments? And how would you describe your dynamic as artists, collaborators, and as friends back then?
It's interesting. So he, long hours, let me just say that. Like, I'm trying to ask so many examples. You know how you get some of these directors, or have heard stories about directors that yell and scream, and Hype is a very, very calm and collected individual, always thinking. And he was so, because of what he was doing had not been done before, artists felt like they were, like, being it, so, okay, so, for artists at that time, no matter how big they were, being able to get a Hype Williams video felt like an accomplishment for them rather than the other way around, rather than the director getting a video for a big time artist, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, and mind you, this is like 2 years, 3 years in of his reign that he was clearly, clearly above and beyond the king of all of it. And so, artists would blow their entire marketing budget on a music video for Hype. And then you would have these artists or companies that had a ton of money that would shoot videos with him back to back, like Bad Boy, you know, whether it was, you know, any of the Biggie stuff or More Money, More Problems. I remember we did that video with him. It was like a 4-day shoot and Big had just passed. And so it was a very emotional thing. And he, you know, it's hard to say. Like, he was just, just a very creative dude. Everything was sort of kept himself as far as like what he wants to do and what's next. And, you know, even when I was ADing for him, you couldn't get a lot of information. You got the information you needed, but creatively, you couldn't get all the information because he shared that with the production designer, or he shared that with the DP. So he sort of compartmentalized his creative thoughts with those who were necessary to implement the things that he needed.
All right. That's interesting.
That makes
completely
sense.
Completely changes and redefines what it is to be an artist, didn't he?
Yeah. So like, for me, it's like, you know, it would make no sense for him to spend 30 minutes talking to me about the colors of the thing or the lights of the, like,
right.
Me, he's like, yo, I need this set up at 2 o'clock and this is the time. Okay, cool. And then my job is to go and make sure everything is set up for him. Right. So that's kind of right. That's how he operated. And I think it functioned very well for him because everybody moved in their own lanes, like his relationship with June and how they created, you know, the fashion side of it with June, him and June Ambrose. It's like, you know, yeah, maybe he would have a conversation with June and the DP about colors of the light he intended to use. And does that make sense with the colors of the clothing, that, you know, that sort of thing. But rarely was there ever this huge sit down pre-production meeting of, okay, I'm going to do this and do that. That's just not how he just didn't operate like that. It's just not the way as an artist that he operated.
Mm-mm. Now, you mentioned More Money, More Problems. You mentioned R. Kelly's Gotham City. What were some of the other videos in that period that you had a hand in assistant hype during the production for?
Oh man, Missy. God, what's the name of The Rain, Can't Stop the Rain, Nas, Hate Me Now, which was crazy. It was such a crazy shoot.
What are your memories of that set?
You know, it's funny because they shot half of it in LA and I wasn't there for that stuff, the stuff on the cross and all that stuff. I wasn't there for that, but all the stuff back in New York I was there for. And that was the first time that I was a first AD for Nas. And so we happened to be shooting in the middle of Queens on the night that Freaky Ta, his funeral. So Freaky Ta was a member of the Lost Boys.
Right.
And he was murdered. And we happened to be filming a few blocks away from his funeral, from his memorial on the same night. And for whatever reason, the guys in the neighborhood and guys from Lost Boys felt disrespected by the fact that we were filming on the same day that they were burying Freaky Ty, or not burying, but having his memorial and his funeral. And so they came to the set to address their issues. It came a couple of times. And so it got really tense. And I don't know if you remember the video, but it's the scene where Puff and Nas are standing on top of the bodega.
I remember.
And so they had come down. We, you know, security was all around. We had them come down. And at one point, you know, I said to Nas, I said, look, there's a little bit of a security risk right at the moment. And, you know, we're going to take a break, maybe go eat and then try to come back and finish some things once that, you know, the threat is, you know, it was a threat assessment and me trying to figure out the best way, because an AD, his number one job is safety on the set. And Nas said, well, where are they? I explained to him what the issue was. He said, well, where are they? I said, well, you know, there's a couple guys over here. Apparently he recognized some of them. He knew who they were. And he approached them and they had a conversation and I stood right there with him and they all talked and it got a little heated, but they understood. He said, this is my job. He said, I'm going to pay my respects to Freaky Todd, but I can't do that right now. This is my job. So I just need y'all to respect that. He said, Ty was my man, you know, Mr. Cheeks, this is Queens, this is family. So let me do my job and then let me come and show my respect. And it was crazy, that deaded it, you know, and it just goes to show that sometimes a conversation is the only thing that needs to happen to avoid conflict, you know, and I was firsthand in that. So that's one memory that I remember. Another memory, which is kind of cool, was More Money, More Problems was being shot at a golf course in Staten Island. And the Locks were there and they had a friend of theirs with them who was just like, he was going around asking everybody, did they rap? Did they want to battle? This, and it was DMX. And he was just like systematically ripping anybody that thought they could rap, or the Pete from the PAs to everybody, to the grid. Anybody that thought they could rap or had verses, he was tearing them apart.
Wow.
And that was the first time I met DMX. And, you know, he was definitely an interesting dude, man, a powerful human being. And yeah, that was just, I remember that specifically because he would just not stop. He was rapping when didn't want to battle. He said he would just go and people would form around him. And it was dope. But that was on that set.
Dope.
Let me see. One more, another one would be Mobb Deep and Lil' Kim. Oh Jesus.
Storm?
Quiet Storm remix, yes.
Right.
So we shot that in the city in Manhattan. And it was the night of the MTV Awards of 1999. And so it was the night that Will Smith brought Afeni Shakur and Miss Wallace on stage together. And it was, it was Big's mom and Pac's mom and them coming on stage together. And it was also the same night that that Lil' Kim showed up with like half her breasts out, was covered in one piece. And Diana Ross like kind of cupped her breast on the stage. So we're actually watching it. We had an overnight call because we knew the awards were happening. So our call was at like 8 o'clock at night. And we would shoot some stuff and then wait for them to get there. So around 12 o'clock at night, Lil' Kim shows up. I mean, she was on cloud nine. Like her energy was crazy. And she shows up, she was already dressed. And we had been shooting some scenes with Mobb Deep and some of the club scenes and stuff like that. And she was like, I want to shoot right now. I'm ready. And we pick her up, put her on top of this, on the bar, and the camera's up and it's ready. And the song comes on and she bursts out with that, that class of hot damn ho, here we go again. Light as a rock. And you could just feel it from her. And it was just a great night because, we had gone through the tragedy of Big and Pac, and to see their mothers on stage, it was just a lot of positive energy that night. And that was like actually a really great shoot for a really dope song. And there was tension. There had been tension between the camps building, between the Mobb Deep camp and the Brooklyn camp. And it was just good to have them all there and to actually get that video done.
Hot damn hole, here we go again. Light as a rock, bitch. Hard as a cop, bitch. This shit not for blocks, through hard tops in the parking lots where my nigga rock like the spark a lot. My Brooklyn style speak for itself, like a wrestler, another notch under my belt. The embezzler, chrome treasurer, the UNO competitor. I'm 10 steps ahead of ya. I'm a leader, y'all on some following shit. Coming in this game on some modeling shit. Bitches suck cock just to get to the top. I put 100% in every line I drop. It's the Q to the B with the M-O-B-B. Queensbridge, Brooklyn, and we D-double-E-P. What? Yeah, wish I lived a life I live. And yo, prodigy, tell them what this is, done. Yo, it's the real shit, shit to make you feel shit. Lump them in the club, shit. Have you wildin' out when you bump this? Drugs to your eardrum, the war uncut. Have a nigga OD, cause it's never enough.
Give me a ballpark of what kind of video budget you were working with when you were starting to build a portfolio and develop your own reputation back then. How big was a typical production in terms of your own crew in the beginning?
So I happen to come in at a great time. I mean, I always tell this joke that, and it's real, it's not even a joke, but the beginning and the end of like the big budget hip hop music videos was Big Pimpin'. When that video was done, we all went to Trinidad, and that was actually the moment that the real first conversation I had with Hype about directing myself. And so we were, I literally watched Def Jam bring in singles, in a clear suitcase into Trinidad that would later be tossed around in the air. It was at that moment that I'm like, man, this could be the end of all of it. If I'm going to do it, I got to do it now, right? So we had a lot of time. That was like that shoot lasted about a week, maybe 5 days, just because of the travel and the amount of shoot days and the pickup days in Miami and all these things. So I had a lot of time to actually sit with Hype and kind of talk through. It was actually one of the shoots that we did sort of break down a lot of things. And he knew that I'd wanted to direct because I was already ADing for X, Little X, and me and X had been talking about it, and you know, he was going to help me get started. I never asked Hype to help me get started as a director. And that was the moment that he said to me, well, if you're going to do it, then you got to stop doing this, meaning being an AD. You can't work for me and X. You got to just go out and you got to do it. You got to take the chance. And so that's sort of when that happened for me. I think I lost track of the question you asked, but I was just thinking about that.
No, that's perfect. I was just wondering, like I say, how big your crew was in the beginning.
Oh, the crew. Yes. Right. So in the beginning, because I was coming out of the Hype Williams Little X camp, you know, we were approaching things in that same world. No one was getting the budgets that Hype was at the beginning. I mean, it was just really hard. And then by the time Big Pimpin' happened, I think the bottom has sort of fallen out of people spending that kind of money on music videos. They didn't understand the return on that investment. So I sort of came in at that time, but I was still getting healthy budgets, $300,000, $400,000 for this. But then what would happen is I would get a budget for $100,000 and still make it look and appear like it was $300,000. So, right. And so I think that was sort of the gift. I would say that's the gift and the curse, because I would approach things as an artist, as a rap artist, or as an artist, a creative visual artist, but also a performing artist, was sort of my mental approach in to it, which it still is to this day when I do them. And I just looked at, I came from that camp, but I clearly approached everything differently, you know, just my experiences in life and all of that. And so when I got a chance to do like Uchiwali, which wasn't a huge budget, I think it was like $100,000 or something like that, and we shot it in Miami and the whole thing, people thought that that was, you know, like $300,000 video because of what we had done. And we shot it all in one day. And then being able to use those as calling cards for other artists is what, you know, is what got me those bigger budgets, like, you know, shooting LL Cool J in Hawaii for $1 million.
Right.
That kind of thing. But yeah, the budgets were good. Like I said, after Big Pimp and the record labels, you know, sort of took inventory of what was being spent and realized that, okay, maybe only a select few artists should get these huge, huge budgets, you know? So.
You direct Uchiwali, which is infamous for being, you know, one of the most divisive Nas songs of all time. But in contrast, it's arguably your most impactful and biggest videos up until that point.
Yeah, it was. It was the one that got me jumped off, because the first video I did was Channel Live, Wild Out 2K. And I was actually on the album as a rapper on the album that song had come from. Channel Live was my friends. Hakeem Green was my roommate. And so getting that first directing gig, it took a lot of heavy lifting. You know, they were signed to Queen Latifah's Flavor Unit Records. And so Q-Tip from Tribe Called Quest was actually supposed to direct the video, but they fought against it and was like, yo, we love Tip, but we want our boy to direct it. And so it was kind of like, oh, you want your boy to do it? That kind of thing. So I had to fight through that in order to get the video. And it was $100,000. And so imagine most people at that time, their first music video is like 10 grand. I had $100,000 music video as my first video, which was a big, Hype didn't even have that for his first one, you know, or X, you know what I mean? So that was a big deal. So I did that. And then I did a video for a guy, you actually probably do know Alliance Ethnique from France. It was a group out of, yeah, Kamel was his name, Alliance Ethnique. And I did a video for him, another $100,000 gig. Oh. And I took those to a production company in New York, Nick Quested's company, Department of Film. And one of the commissioners who knew me over the years for being the AD on all the Nas videos and all this stuff mentioned to Nas that I was directing. And he was like, oh, we should get Sun. You know, that's what Nas got. We should get Sun to do Uchiwali. And I met with him, and then that's kind of how that started. So Nas was very instrumental in you know, as also in part of my breakthrough and getting going. Yeah.
Will it lead you to later on directing another video with Nas during the height of his beef with Jay-Z, specifically mm-hmm. Got Yourself a Gun? What kind of statement were you making with Got Yourself a Gun?
Wow, it was interesting. We had come off of the success of Uchiwali. I think it was probably about 8 months later that we did Got Yourself a Gun. And maybe 4 months or 5 months after the initial Hot 97 incident went with Jay-Z. Mm. And so there were a few directors up for it. It was a very pivotal moment for hip hop. And so I met with Nas, had a call with him, and I kind of pitched this idea of Nas being Malcolm X and Martin Luther King on the nights they were assassinated. So the original concept was to recreate Memphis, Tennessee, the Lorraine Motel of Memphis, Tennessee, in the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem, New York. And wow. So he loved the idea. We'd written it up. The label loved it because we were like 4 years or 5 years after Big and Pac. And I love Jay-Z. Like, I would see Jay-Z. Jay-Z's cousin is a frat brother of mine that I know very well. I'd been around Jay-Z a lot. Like, this was the last thing that anybody wanted was for Nas and Jay-Z to actually turn into the Big and Pac situation. For a lot of reasons. Big and Pac situation, it was coastal, you know, bi-coastal. So there was that idea of separation of folks. But this was like New York, like this was just not good. So I wanted to make a statement that was sort of addressing the issue, but also could show what could happen. And maybe we should just keep this on wax and let's not do this. So I was in a club with Hakeem Green from Channel Live, and he turned to me. He said, you know, I don't know if the kids, meaning the generation, is going to understand the statement you're making with the video. I said, what you mean? He said, well, we understand it because we college educated and we read books and Black Power and this and that and whatever. But are the kids going to get it with Malcolm X and Martin? Is it going to be over their heads? And is it going to be too, too educated, so to speak? I said, man, you're right. You might be right. So what do we do? And we talked about it. And the idea came out that they would be, Nas would be Biggie and Pac on the nights they were killed. And that just, the chills that came over my body when we, as the concept was created, was just like, we have to do it. So I literally ran out of the club. I called Horse, who was Nas's bodyguard. He got Nas on the phone. I said, scrap that other idea. This is the concept. This is the idea. And he was quiet. And he said, yo, son, we got to do that. That's what we got to do. And that's how that happened. That's exactly how that happened.
Oh, the top feels so much better than the bottom. So much better.
Maybe use a window shopper. You mad at me? I think I know why. Maybe use a window shopper. In the jewelry store, looking at shit you came by. Maybe use a window shopper.
Fifty was like the guy who was so powerful in the business because he had already appeared on the scene. You know what I mean? with power of the dollar. I want to make sure I'm saying power of the dollar,
right?
And you know, how to rob and all this stuff. So he was making such a noise, and then when he got shot, everybody thought it was all over, you know. But then he comes back with the mixtapes and the G Unit and Stronger Than Ever. And so by the time he reinserted himself back into hip hop and became that mainstay figure, he was the artist that everybody wanted to work with. You know, and I got my opportunity to film him on Just a Little Bit, and we went to Mexico. And I, you know, most of my videos, I like a lot of them, I like to do some sort of narrative story to it. And so I had pitched this idea of this heist, and you know, he sets these guys up that have wronged him with these, you know, with these women out of the country. And it was, you know, it was a great video, and it was a dope idea that we implemented. And then we did fuck, man, my memory's got me there, Bobby. Window Shopper, yes, from the movie. Right. And that was France. And funny enough, I wasn't the original director on that. Someone else was. So they couldn't do it because they had a prior commitment. And so I actually stepped in with their concept to direct the video. So that's actually one of the only times I've ever directed a video that I didn't write the concept for. That I didn't do the concept for.
Interesting.
Yeah. Then we did a couple of videos. We did quite a few joints. But yeah, it was just, you know, it's incredible. Anytime you are like connected to an artist sort of like at the height of their reign, and you're able to give the visuals, you know, create visuals and impacting images for them, it's always a great feeling, man. Because you know you're connected to history, you know? You know you're connected to history.
What kind of creative decisions and questions are you asking yourself when an artist gives you a song? And how soon into hearing a song do you typically start to figure out an idea for a video?
So I have this idea, and I think somebody stole my words. What does the song look like? And I said that in another interview a little while back. Because I was a rapper at one time, you record a record, and immediately you're thinking about a video for it if the song is hot. And like, what is it? What's this going to be? What's this going to be, right? And so I always want to collaborate with the artist. It was a thing where I learned that later on in my career, that the best work comes when you collaborate directly with an artist on what the visual is going to be. And I won't say too much later, but when you had access to the artist, especially if it's a new artist, like an example is with Sierra, when we did Goodies, I mean, we talked about this idea and the concept and everything about it for a month before we even shot the video. Wow. You know, it was the first song. Yeah, like directly. And we talked about the dance was going to be, the color, like everything was already, we had thought about it. And I, from that was the time I was like, man, this is the way to work for me, like talking to commissioners and A&Rs and stuff like that. Prior to that LL, when I did Love You Better, that was a video that I went, me, LL, and Eric Nix sat in the studio. He played the record for the first time, and we didn't leave the studio until the treatment was done. You know, that's, to me, is the best way to do it. It's artist to artist. What does this song look like? And you can sit and kick ideas around, and no idea is a bad idea. It's just not, maybe not the one we want to use, you know? So that's my approach. That's what I like to do. I like to have that one-on-one interaction with an artist. So it's just not so, you know, so it feels honest. It feels creative,
right?
You know, you get a vibe. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think that storyboards are as viable now as they used to be as pre-production research tools back then?
I think so. I think that especially if you're doing things with special effects and big set pieces and action, those things, yeah, you definitely need storyboards for things like that. If your idea is so expansive that, again, back to kind of what the thing I was talking about with hype, the sharing of your idea and who you actually sharing what you're thinking with who and what part of it you're sharing with them. I think storyboards, once you get those created, they become like the blueprint for everything. So I tend to my personal thought about storyboards, when you do them, it sort of handcuffs you to having to do what's on that board and everyone feeling like they're part of the creative process. Not that they're not, but everybody feeling like, oh, we didn't get that shot that was the low angle with the guy's hand and the thing. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
That thing sort of, you know, you're directing by committee, and that's something that I just don't like, you know? So the storyboard things are definitely good when you got a stunt coordinator, a visual effects guy, the DP, the AD, the guy driving the car and all those things. Excuse me. Everybody needs to be on the same page about what you're trying to capture. So I do think they're necessary. And, you know, in the commercial world, they're very necessary because you're selling 30 seconds or a minute worth of imagery. So every single frame is important, as opposed to this music video medium where you're sort of shooting things outside of what you told everybody you were going to do just because you can and because you're painting a picture, you know, so.
And how long are you typically in the editing room for, and to what extent is that edit informing these creative decisions and directions?
Yeah, you know, that's changed a lot, man, over the years. I got to be honest, like there was a time when, you know, the way this used to work is when we shot on film, you'd get the film, you shoot it like the next day or the day after, you would do all your coloring, and then you would take all that colored film would be transferred to a digital edited format for editing. And then that would be taken to your editor and you sit with your editor and you know, that whole thing. But now, because everything is shot digitally, the process is backwards. You color the edited version. When you get into a scenario where you have an editor that you trust and that knows your vision all the time, and you know, you collaborate with them with the treatment and that sort of thing, you give them time. I like to give editors time. Like, hey man, take 3 days. This is what I want. Once you're done, show it to me, and then we're going to get in and tighten it up. That's kind of the way, that's the process that I've, you know, I think matured to, I'll say that. Because before I was a little bit more just too hands-on, you know, if that makes sense. Because you feel like you have to be, you know, oh, I'm new. Nobody's going to respect me. They're not going to understand my vision, da-da-da-da-da. And then you realize that you start to shoot towards the edit and you become more, you know, you just become stronger as a director and you don't overshoot. You only shoot the things you need. And if you're shooting other things that you don't need that weren't discussed, you could tell the editor, hey, you know what? I saw this idea when we got to the location and I shot this scene. I want to put that in, you know, XYZ part of the video. So that's how I work now.
What's it like creating visuals for somebody like Busta Rhymes, somebody who's as visionary as Busta, and what kind of space does he put you in with his perspective that might, you know, change your access creatively?
Yeah, Busta's completely cooperative. Like it's a two-handed thing with him. So if he, most of the time he comes to you with an idea for a song, for a video, for a song. I'm talking, I can't remember, maybe once or twice. I think Mr. and Mrs. Smith, the one we did for I Love My Chick with him and Gabrielle Union, that was one video where I completely had the concept based, and it kind of came to me because his last name was Smith. And I'm like, oh, snap. And it's the girl and it's, you know, let's do this. But most of the time, Busta's coming with the ideas, a nucleus of that, just a small portion of the idea. Or it might be a photo that he saw somewhere. And he's like, yo, this photo makes me think of XYZ. I'm wondering, how do we expand this image into a complete concept? And that's how he works. I mean, you know, he's coming off of Put Your Hands Where My Eyes Can See and Dangerous and all those, you know, classic joints. And so each time he does something, it's a competition really for himself to change with the times, but also still be as impactful visually that he was 25, you know, now 30 years ago, you know. So with him, it's always collaborative effort. And it's always collaborative. It's never like, hey, here's the idea, we're going to shoot. No. He's going to implement something into that idea or bring it to you to implement.
If you had, you know, 5-6 hours to live, and I don't suspect that to be happening anytime soon, which of all of your music videos that you've made would you want to watch again? And which of all the music videos in history would you want to watch again?
In history, I want to see all the early the Michael Jackson Thriller joints and the Michael Jackson Thriller joints, some of the early British videos, the U2s and Duran Durans, because those were the videos that I really like would catch on TV, on some of those late programs that showed music videos and really made me go, wow, this is great. Wham and Culture Club and all of that stuff. You know, it was just so much happening at that time with videos, because we didn't really have videos of our own in terms of hip hop, and sort of like the British wave of music videos was sort of, that was a counter culture to what was happening in America. So I would love to, you know, watch those. And then, you know, just the big hip hop joints, like some of the ones I've done, and maybe even some of the R&B ones, like A. Marie, Why Don't We Fall in Love, Robin Thicke, Lost Without You, some of the Nicki Minaj joints that we've done, because I'm really, you know, really proud of those. Those incredibly, incredibly visually graphic videos of Little X, where he could take the line, you know, paint a line in the middle of a wall, and it was just so artistic and dope, you know. That's, you know, I would spend some time doing that.
What's next with Benny Boom?
Oh man, more TV, feature films, you know, wanting to explore some more stories. I really want to explore some stories about my hometown, about Philadelphia. We have a lot of interesting stories that are, you know, in our history and also currently. The city is going through a really bad time right now. It's like the number two city in per capita in murders. And it's just, you know, it's sad to see that the city go down that way. And, you know, we just want to be able to do something that not only shines a light on some of the stories there, but also reminds people of how great of a city it is and the people that it produces and how game-changing and world-changing we can be, to give some hope to it. So that, you know, that's one thing, and continue the directing career to the next phase of, you know, more scripted television, in streaming television and all those things to keep it going, man, and keep this thing going.
I wish I could show my appreciation for this
podcast.
I wish I could respond to it somehow or be notified in the future when
Fly Fidelity
updates, because it's so great. But I don't think there's a way I can do any of those things.
Uh-oh. You're wrong.
Subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and SoundCloud, and never miss an episode. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
My people, are you with me where you at?